Chapter 9. Corey came to a sudden halt, along with Abner Strayhorn and the other men marching along the road toward the new positions they would take up along Peachtree Creek. They were passing a two-story white frame house that served as the headquarters for the Army of Tennessee. The front door of the house opened, and a small, slight, gray-uniformed figure stepped out on the gallery. The man wore no hat, so that his balding head was visible. So was the neat gray goatee on his chin. Every one of the troops lined up along the road recognized General Joseph Johnston, the man who, until the previous night, had been their commander. All along the line, the Confederate soldiers began to remove their hats. Corey did, too, although he had not served under Johnston for as long as some of these men. While it was true that Johnston had been unable to stop the Yankee advance into Georgia, he had fought stubbornly every step of the way and had retreated only when there was no other option remaining to him. The troops began walking again, slowly passing the house where Johnston stood watching them, a solemn expression on his face. No one cheered, or rattled sabers, or waved hats in the air. The demonstration was a quiet one, but there was no mistaking the admiration and affection these men felt for their former commander. Some of their officers walked over to the house and reached up to the gallery to shake the general's hand, then hurried to catch up with their men. Johnston stood there until everyone had passed, lifting a hand just a little in farewell.
"Head's a fighter, from what I hear tell,"
Abner said to Corey as they trudged down the road.
"He got his left arm tore up at Gettysburg and lost his right leg at Chickamauga, but just keeps on a-going. But I don't know if he'll ever be able to make the fellers feel about him the way they do about old General."
"I don't reckon that matters," Corey said, "as long as Hood can win the fight that's coming."
There was no doubt on either side that another battle was imminent. Sherman, hearing of the Confederate change of command and being advised by some of his generals who were personally acquainted with Hood from their days at West Point that Hood would strike quickly, moved to forestall such an attack. He cast his forces in a great arc north of Atlanta and struck first from the east, rather than coming in from the northwest where the Confederate line was strongest. Union troops, led by General James B. McPherson, reached the railroad east of Atlanta and turned back to the west, tearing up the rails as they proceeded toward the city. Most of the civilians left in Atlanta fled when word of this Yankee thrust reached them. Meanwhile, the blue-clad troops under Generals Schofield and Thomas maneuvered north of the city, trying to get in position to attack. When Hood's scouts brought him news of those movements, he seized on a plan to hit the Yankees, Thomas's command in particular, as they were crossing Peachtree Creek. Hardee's corps would lead the attack, falling on the Federals and driving them into an angle of ground formed where the creek flowed into the Chattahoochee River, where they could be destroyed. That was Hood's plan, at any rate. Corey knew only that he and Abner were moving up as part of Hardee's command, tramping through the woods and slogging across marshy fields as they moved north of the city. The mid-July sun beat down fiercely. It was a poor day for a battle, Corey thought, as he sleeved sweat off his forehead. But then, any day was a poor day for a battle as far as he was concerned. A little over a year had passed since the fall of Vicksburg, he thought. Up north in Pennsylvania, Robert E. Lee had been defeated the day before at a place called Gettysburg. After that bleak day, many people in the South, if they were honest with themselves, wouldn't have given a hoot in hell for the chances of the Confederacy surviving for another year. But then had come Chickamauga, which showed that the Yankees weren't unbeatable after all. And the failed federal campaign to take Richmond that had come to a bloody end with the slaughter at Cold Harbor back in May. Although embattled, the Confederacy was hanging on. It was still possible, with elections in the North coming up in the fall, that things could change. If that stubborn bastard Lincoln was voted out of office, whoever took his place might be more open to a reasonable settlement with the Confederacy. The South had paid the highest price in blood and death and destruction, but some folks up north were tired of the war, too. They just wanted it to come to an end, one way or another. Such sentiment was the Confederacy's last best hope. So putting up a fight still served a purpose, Corey told himself. Perhaps victory was no longer in the cards for the South, but with luck and dedication it might avoid an outright defeat. His hands tightened on his rifle as a single shot barked out from somewhere up ahead. Following that report, a couple of seconds of silence ticked by, pregnant with anticipation. Then, with a sudden roar, like the breaking of a thunderstorm, the battle was underway. Shouting, Corey and Abner joined the surge forward. They emerged from a stretch of woods into an open field. A couple of hundred yards away, on the other side of the field, a line of trees marked the course of the creek. The field was covered with Yankees, who looked like they had been taken completely by surprise. Corey spotted a few tents, as if the Federals had started setting up camp. Now, though, the Yankees found themselves with a desperate struggle on their hands. Howling and firing, hundreds of Confederates ran forward. In a matter of heartbeats, the Southerners found themselves amid the Federal troops. Hand-to-hand fighting broke out, with pistols, rifle butts, bayonets, even sticks and fists serving as the weapons of the moment. Side by side, Corey and Abner bounded up to a group of Yankees. They had held off on firing until now. Knowing that they might get off only one shot each, they wanted it to be a sure thing. Corey leveled his rifle at one of the Yankees, who turned a shocked face toward him. He pressed the trigger and felt the weapon kick hard against his shoulder. His hand stung from flecks of burning powder given off by the rifle's discharge. Through the smoke, he saw his target stagger. Blood welled from the Yankee's mouth. But that didn't stop the man from lifting the pistol in his hand and firing. Corey saw the flame from the gun's muzzle, felt, more than heard, the bullet slap the air beside his ear. Before the Union soldier could draw back the hammer to cock the pistol again, Corey lunged forward and buried his bayonet in the man's belly. The Federal screamed and slumped forward, almost pulling the rifle out of Corey's hand. He ripped the bayonet loose and used the butt of the rifle to knock the dying Yankee out of his way. An officer slashed at him with a saber. Corey parried the blade with his bayonet, then thrust the sharp tip at the man's face. The Yankee jerked back and whipped his saber around in a backhand. Corey tried to twist out of the way. The blade raked across his stomach, tearing open his shirt and leaving a shallow cut on the skin underneath. He smashed the Yankee's skull with the rifle butt, experiencing a fierce surge of satisfaction as he felt bones splinter and shatter under the blow. The Yankees, not expecting the attack so soon, even though they knew of Hood's aggressive nature, fell back to the creek. So fierce was the Confederate assault that many of the Federal troops jumped into the creek and risked drowning as they swam away, rather than stand up to the attack. Abner grabbed Corey's arm. "Come on!" he shouted over the din of battle. "We're going to take that bridge down yonder." They turned, along with quite a few of the other Confederates, and charged downstream to the spot where Peachtree Creek was spanned by a sturdy stone bridge. If they could capture the bridge, the Yankees on this side of the creek would have no way to escape except by swimming. As the men approached the bridge, Federal artillery batteries, hastily set up on the other side of the creek, opened fire. Corey heard the deafening roar, saw the gush of smoke from the trees on the opposite bank, and watched men tumble off their feet as shells ripped through the Confederate charge. Canister rounds exploded, shredding whatever human flesh was within reach of their deadly loads. Solid shot decapitated some men and tore others in half. It was grisly work, and Corey knew his life might end at any second with little or no warning. He dropped to a knee and reloaded his rifle. Beside him, Abner did likewise. When they were finished, both men drew beads on the artillerymen across the creek. Corey fired, and Abner squeezed off his shot a second later. Two of the gunners were knocked away from their cannon. Two more men, however, leapt forward to take their places. Always there were more Yankees. They were like sand fleas, Corey thought. It was impossible to squash all of them. Not only that, but up ahead on the bridge that the Confederates had sought to capture, more blue-uniformed troops poured across the creek. The Yankees had been surprised, but they had gathered their wits enough to launch a counterattack.